History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states. Guinevere, Athena, Isis, Lilith, Joan of Arc, even Mulan, Snow White, and Cinderella. The mythology and folklore of the world is full of goddesses, queens, witches, and in a word, women. Women with powers, women with courage, women with wisdom, and women with wile. There are so many interesting women in these tales that it would be easy to say start a podcast dedicated just to the ladies of lore. And that's exactly what we have for you on today's Saturday Matinee, an episode on Deirdre of the Sorrows, a story of prophecy, exile, and doomed love. I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow Ladies of Lore. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to Ladies of Lore, the podcast where we take all of the most wonderful women of mythology and folklore from all over the world and we unpick, unravel and explore their origins, their stories and how they've changed through time to arrive in today's modern world. I'm India and I'm so grateful to have you here with me today. Can you believe it's February already? I was having quite a good January actually until I had a car crash. I almost made it to the end of January without incident, but yes, car crash. I'm all right. Everyone's okay. Nobody got hurt. My car is not okay. The other car, absolutely fine. Mine, not fine, but that's okay. It's all good. I'm sure there's some kind of like physics that could explain why that happened, but this is not a physics podcast. Anyway, if you are new to the podcast, welcome on in. Now, I know there are many, 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 many new faces since the last episode was released. And I think I'm probably right when I say that most of you have found the podcast through TikTok. So a huge thank you to coming over from TikTok and actually following and then actually listening. I appreciate you so much. I was a bit blown away by the response to the TikTok that I made. I was not expecting so many of you wonderful people to watch, comment and just in general be so very kind and positive about the podcast. I appreciate all of your comments. You were all so sweet. So sweet. I will also be trying to make more TikToks. Having my face out there is very much not the norm for me and not something I'm usually comfortable with doing, but I'm trying because there's lots of people out there that might enjoy the podcast and I'm trying to reach you all. So if you don't already follow me on TikTok and you would like to, you can find all of the information for that in the show notes of every episode. If you are a Patreon member of any tier, free or paid, you might have also seen that I have relaunched The Scroll, which is my fortnightly newsletter for all Patreon members. You do not need to pay for anything to get that. And it's going to include lots of things and lots of stuff, including but not limited to further write-ups on figures from mythology, folklore and history, little mini explorations into things like books, movies, TV shows and music that I might have enjoyed and that resonates with what we talk about on the podcast. Any little extras and bits and pieces that I might have cut from episodes but want to discuss, maybe some discussions around relevant current events, examinations of art or artifacts. And you'll also be the very first to know what exciting things we have to come on the podcast. And trust me, I've said this before, but I really mean it. I have some really exciting things coming up. I have been talking to some very, very incredible people who are going to come on this podcast. Watch this space. But if you want to be the first to know about that, it is in the free newsletter on Patreon. The last thing that I want to mention, and I pinky promise you this is the final thing before I get to the actual point of today, is that I'm also going to be relaunching the Ladies of Law Book Club very, very soon. And this may or may not, maybe, it might relate to the exciting things that I have coming up for you in the next few months. I'm side-eyeing you right now. I'm like side-eyeing you and doing a big, obvious wink. You can't see it, but I am doing it. So if you're interested in knowing more about that or in joining it, please do consider joining the Discord or the Patreon or both, and you'll get everything you need to do that. Again, this is for everybody. This is not something you have to pay for. Right, I think that about covers all of it. So what are we talking about this week? Well, we are headed back to Ireland to talk about the tragic figure of Deirdre. I really love talking about Irish mythology, and I haven't done it in a little while, so we're going to head back there. And this was a suggestion from Jessica, so thank you so much, Jessica. As always, I'm going to do my bestest when it comes to pronunciation. I do try and take the time to really look up pronunciations and get them right, but I'm very much aware I'm not always right. I just can't always be right. So please feel free to correct me if I am wrong. I want to be corrected. I want to say things correctly. So if I'm wrong and you might know how to say it better than me, please tell me in the comments. Okay, right, if you are ready, if you got a little drink, a little snack, some of you said you're going to listen on your commutes. Please be safe if you are. Don't follow my example and have any car accidents. We don't want that. Okay, let's go. Deirdre, one of the most haunting figures of Irish mythology, emerges not from a pantheon of gods and goddesses, but more from an intricate web of mytho-historical storytelling in the Ulster Cycle. We've talked about that before, right at the start of this podcast, on the episode about the Morrigan. But for those that don't know, the Ulster Cycle is one of the four great cycles in early Irish literature. The other three being the mythological, the Fenian, and the historical or the King's Cycles. And the Ulster Cycle consists of heroic tales, mostly set in the province of Ulster, centering on the court of King Cathair Mac Nessa at Avon Vaca. And it features some legendary warriors such as Cú Chulainn, Fergus Mac Ruaidh, and Deirdre. Composed between the 8th and 12th centuries, but rooted in a lot of older oral tradition, the Ulster Cycle reflects a pre-Christian warrior aristocracy. And it takes themes like honour, loyalty, prophecy, and tragic fate, and it dramatises them. And these stories are often characterised by very raw emotion, lots of complex interpersonal relationships and dynamics, and very vivid poetic language. And these stories, they likely originated in the early Iron Age Celtic society of Ireland, sometime between about 500 BCE and 100 BCE. But they were first committed into writing by Christian monks, like I said, between the 8th and 12th centuries. So keep that in mind, because this means that the Ulster Cycle reflects a bit of a fusion of pagan oral tradition and Christian scribal culture, preserving myths that had circulated for centuries in bardic and storytelling traditions. I want to give you a little bit of context. I like to do this. I really enjoy giving you the context, because it does help to really put the stories and these figures into, well, into context. That's the point of context. I started to talk then and I thought, what word am I going to use now? What word? It puts them into context and just helps you to really understand what their function was. Why did people need that figure? Why did people want that figure? What did they recognise in that figure? So anyway, at the time that these stories were being written down, Ireland was not really a unified nation. It was more of a patchwork of small tribal kingdoms, and each one was ruled by a local king. And these kingdoms were often engaged in rivalries and warfare. And that's very much reflected in the Ulster Cycle's emphasis on inter-tribal conflict, feasting halls and you know, special warrior codes. Because society was very much structured around this hierarchical clan system. And things like honour, kinship and hospitality were central cultural values. The early medieval period in Ireland was also marked by the spread of Christianity, the growth of monasteries, and a written literary culture that began to preserve the pre-Christian myths. So rather than erasing all of the old stories, Irish monks often recorded them. And sometimes they subtly altered them to align more with Christian morality, while still preserving their pagan core. And as a result, the Ulster Cycle serves as maybe a cultural bridge between Celtic paganism and Christianized Ireland. So in essence, the Ulster Cycle emerged from a world in which oral heroic culture, rooted in tribal warrior-based societies, was being filtered through the lens of Christian monastic scholarship. And what do you get when you do that? Well, you get literature that is archaic but also timeless, and it's steeped in the world of Iron Age chieftains but framed within medieval practice. And Deirdre's story as part of the Ulster Cycle is deeply shaped by this context. Her tale is one of beauty and exile and tragic fate, and it reflects the warrior codes and tribal loyalties of early Iron Age Ireland, where personal honour and kinship, like I said, were paramount, and also where a woman's body and destiny were bound to political alliances. Yet the fact that her story was preserved and recorded by Christian scribes suggests that her narrative had some enduring symbolic power, which transcended these pagan origins. And in Deirdre, we see a woman who challenges the expectations of pagan tribal society and Christian moral order, a figure whose sorrow and resistance made her not only unforgettable, but also culturally essential across centuries. And despite not being a goddess in the strict sort of theological sense, Deirdre occupies a symbolic role that transcends mere mortal character. And her story stands at this intersection of oral tradition and literary formalization. And it reflects a transformation of divine femininity into a heroic archetype. And this is a shift from goddess to mortal woman imbued with destiny. And while she's not listed among the Tuatha De Danann, which is the traditional pantheon of Irish deities, she does carry traits that are reminiscent of earlier Celtic goddesses. And probably one of the most significant parallels is the Morrigan, who was a complex war and fate goddess, often appearing as a triple deity. The Morrigan is associated with both beauty and destruction. She's able to foretell the outcome of battles and manipulate events through prophecy and seduction. And like Deirdre, she embodies this terrible power of knowledge and forewarning, and her presence often signals doom. And we've spoken about that on our episode about the Morrigan, which you can go back and listen to if you like. It's one of the first ones I did, I think. And then there's Eru, who is a sovereignty goddess, and it is after her that Ireland is named. Eru represents the land itself, and her favour or refusal can determine the legitimacy of a king's rule. Deirdre, in some nationalists and feminist interpretations, echoes Eru as a symbol of Ireland violated by conquest, her body and autonomy used to forge or break political power. And it's through these types of connections we see that Deirdre is not a theological goddess, but she is a narratively divine figure. She's a literary echo of earlier female figures who wield power through things like beauty, like choice and autonomy, and prophecy, often paying a bit of a steep price for their agency. The primary literary source for the story of Deirdre is Longus MacNicheolain. And this is a tale that was preserved in the 12th century Book of Leinster. But remember, there will be earlier versions that have existed in oral traditions or in now very long lost manuscripts. And you know by now, I'm going to give you some context on that because I can't say no. I can't resist. You're going to get the context. The Book of Leinster is probably one of the most important and extensive medieval Irish manuscripts. It was created around the mid-12th century, and it was produced at the monastic centre of Clonmacnoise, and it's associated with Aidh Ú Crimhan, who was a cleric and a scribe, and probably the person who was most responsible for compiling the Book of Leinster. And it contains over 180 distinct texts, and that includes things like mythological stories, genealogies, lists of kings, poetries, historical annals, and theological material as well. And it is one of the key sources for the Ulster cycle, the mythological cycle, and a lot of early Irish lore. And what makes the Book of Leinster really, really significant is it preserves stories that would otherwise be lost, rendering it not just sort of a repository of myth, but it's like a cultural bank of memories for early Ireland. And although it was written by Christian monks, it maintains a quite surprising level of respect and preservation for pagan themes. And the manuscript is now housed at Trinity College in Dublin, and it has been partially digitised, and you can actually see some excerpts and translations online at the Celt Project. And this is hosted by the University College Cork, and I'll put the link to that in the show notes so you can actually go and have a look at that. I spent quite a lot of time looking at that, I'm not going to lie. I enjoyed it very much, and I'm sure there will be some of you that do as well. But yes, that is where you can find the earliest known written form of the story of Deirdre. And this is usually where I would talk about what Deirdre looked like, but her iconography is quite sparse, and that's mainly due to the nature of Celtic art, which usually leaned a bit more towards abstract symbolism than really specific figural depiction. But associations are found in red-haired beauty and wild nature and lamenting, being sorrowful and sad. But all accounts agree that she was very, very beautiful. And ritual worship of Deirdre is not really documented in any historical sources because she is, like I said, more of a mytho-literary figure rather than a cultic deity. But her story was likely told in bardic traditions, echoing throughout Irish culture as a lesson in the dangers of beauty, fate, and male control. So she's kind of part of the broader cultural reverence for women of strength and tragedy. So she aligns with heroines like Ema and Grainne. So now we know a little bit about Deirdre and about the context within which she arrived. Shall I tell you the story of Deirdre of the Sorrows? In the ancient kingdom of Ulster, where kings ruled from the stronghold of Avon Vaca, a feast was underway in the great hall of Cruachan Mac Nessa. The firelight flickered across polished spears and golden torches. Goblets were raised and songs of war and honour echoed off the stone walls. The guests were nobles, warriors, poets, and those favoured by fate and familiar with blood. Among them sat Felimid Mac Doileran, one of the king's bards, a man respected for his storytelling and lineage. But that evening, it was not Felimid's words that stirred the court. Instead, it was a sound from within his pregnant wife. She cried out mid-feast, and the hall fell silent. The king, curious and perhaps wary of omens, turned to his druid. Cavad, seer of Ulster, stepped forward. He closed his eyes and listened, not to the cry, but to what lay beneath it. The murmurs of fate. What he spoke next would cast a shadow over all of Ulster. There will be great peril upon the world. There will be a bloody house in Ireland. There will be a conflict between two kings, and great slaughter between two peoples. There will be the tale of a girl, and her sleep will be taken from her. A girl will be born amongst the fairest of women. So beautiful, her story will be known throughout Ireland, among kings and warriors, women and commoners alike. And her name shall be Deirdre. At these words, dread descended on the court. Some nobles rose to their feet, demanding the child be killed at birth, lest her beauty bring ruin to the land. But the king, ever calculating, saw another way. If she would be so beautiful and so dangerous, he would not destroy her. He would possess her. And so he made a decision. The child would be raised in secret, far from the eyes of men, watched over by a nurse in a secluded forest home. And when she came of age, she would become his queen. Her beauty would be controlled, and the prophecy would be neutralized.
History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit Progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
The years passed and Deirdre grew into a woman exactly as foretold. Radiant, beautiful, impossible to forget. She was the most beautiful woman Ireland had ever seen. One day, Deirdre saw a raven feeding on a slain calf in the snow and said to her nurse, "I could love a man with those three colours. My true love will be a man with skin as white as snow, cheeks flushed with the colour of blood, and hair like a raven's wing." To that, her nurse replied, "There is such a man. His name is Nisha, son of Uslu, of the Red Branch." Deirdre's fate was sealed. She longed for Nisha with such intensity that when they finally met, she did not wait to be wooed. She wooed him. Nisha, noble and loyal, hesitated at first, knowing that she was promised to the king. But Deirdre had one last terrible power to call upon. She placed a geish upon Nisha, a binding vow, a moral command that could not be refused without bringing lifelong shame and ruin. Once spoken, it was inescapable. From that moment on, Nisha no longer listened to his own doubts, nor to the warnings of his brothers. Bound by honour and fate, he took Deirdre's hand. Together they fled, with Nisha's brothers beside them, their followers and hounds racing after them. They crossed the length of Ireland, from stronghold to shoreline, until they reached Rathlin, and from there, they took to the sea, finally finding refuge across the water at Loch Etive. There they lived in fragile happiness, hunted and wandering. For Deirdre, it was freedom for a time, but the king had not forgotten. His desire, his humiliation, his wounded pride, these festered. Years later, he sent the respected warrior Fergus MacRoig with a message. "Return to Ulster and be forgiven." Swearing on a sacred honour, Fergus guaranteed their safety. When Fergus set foot on the shores of Alba, he loosed a great shout into the air. A call that was meant to be heard. It rolled across the land and found Deirdre and Nisha, where they sat in hiding. The quiet click of chess pieces between them. Nisha was on his feet in an instant. "That cry comes from Ireland," he said. Deirdre reached for his hand, her voice calm, though her heart was not. "No," she said softly. "You are mistaken. Sit with me. Finish the game." Then the second shout came, even stronger than the first. Nisha rose again, restless now. "That is an Ulsterman's voice." Deirdre shook her head, forcing a smile. "You're letting your imagination run away with you." And this time, Nisha allowed himself to be drawn back down. Then, the third shout rang out. Unmistakable. Undeniable. Nisha stiffened. "That is Fergus," he said. And without another word, he went to meet him. Deirdre's composure broke. She knew what this meant, because the night before, she had dreamed of a raven flying from Ireland, three drops of honey clenched in its beak. When the bird landed, the honey fell, and each drop turned to blood. The meaning was clear. Fergus would convince Nisha and his brothers to return home, and no plea of hers would be enough to stop it. So when the ship was made ready and the brothers stepped aboard, Deirdre followed, with a heart already heavy with grief. She wept as Alba's coastline faded into the sea, and she sang a lament for the mountains and the glens and the wooded places where she had known love without fear. From that crossing onward, she would be remembered as Deirdre of the Sorrows. As they travelled through Ireland toward the royal court, the king's curiosity curdled into something darker. He wanted to know, before they arrived, whether Deirdre's beauty had endured. So he sent a servant ahead to spy on them. The man crept to their lodgings and peered through a window, but Naoise saw him. Without hesitation, he hurled a chess piece and struck the servant in the eye, blinding him. Even so, the man returned and delivered his report. There is no woman in the world whose face or form is more beautiful than hers. In that moment, the brothers understood the truth. They had been betrayed. And the king, now desperate to see them destroyed, turned to sorcery. At his command, the druid summoned a great unnatural tide, a roaring sea that rose around them though they stood on dry land. Waves crashed where there should have been earth. The brothers were forced to swim through it as if drowning in open air. Naoise lifted Deirdre onto his shoulders, holding her above the surging waters, and together they fought on until exhaustion overcame them. Then the king called for their deaths, but none of his warriors would move, none except Mainyr Roughhand, son of the king of Norway, whose father and two brothers had once fallen by Naoise's blade. Mainyr stepped forward and offered to kill the brothers one by one. The brothers begged to die first, but Naoise stopped them. He handed Mainyr his own sword, the blade gifted by the sea god, a weapon said to cut down anything in its path. With that sword, Mainyr struck, and with a single blow, all three sons fell. Deirdre was dragged, shattered with grief, to the king's court. He heaped gifts upon her, but she flung them aside and refused to even look at him. Enraged, the king demanded to know if there was any man she hated more than he. "There is," she said. "Mainyr Roughhand, for he killed my Naoise." The king smiled cruelly. He summoned Mainyr and told Deirdre she would live with him for a year. Then he forced her onto Mainyr's chariot, seating himself on one side and Mainyr on the other, mocking her, saying she was like a ewe trapped between two rams, desperate and broken. Deirdre chose her own ending. She hurled herself from the chariot and dashed her body against a rock. She died there, her lifeless form coming to rest near the grave of Naoise. Her death ignited a war against the king of Ulster. Fergus, the well-meaning messenger who had brought them home, led the charge. The king's own son and grandson were killed, and many warriors fled Ulster to seek refuge under the king of Connacht. In the end, the druid's prophecy was fulfilled. Deirdre had brought sorrow not only upon herself, but upon an entire kingdom. So there you go, there's the tale of Deirdre. And although it's not a tale about a goddess in a very strict theological sense, it does echo this sort of idea of fate-bearing women of myth that you find across many different cultures, Cassandra, Helen. And Deirdre's story is one of beauty used as prophecy, of agency punished, of a woman caught in the crossfire of male politics and pride. But it's also a story of a woman who chose love, who spoke and acted and did so even when silence was expected. And she is Deirdre of the Sorrows, and her name is still spoken today. But before we get to today, let's have a little look at how Deirdre changed through time. Over the centuries, Deirdre's character has undergone significant transformation, reflecting shifting social values, political movements, and evolving ideas of national identity. In her medieval context, her story served primarily as a didactic warning. It was a tale cautioning against defying fate, social hierarchy, and the authority of kings, especially in the face of things like passionate love and personal desire. And her fate, which was suicide after betrayal and loss, was both a moral closure and a reinforcement of societal order. However, as Ireland moved into the early modern and colonial eras, interpretations of Deirdre began to shift a little bit, shaped by profound social, political, and cultural unrest. From the 17th century onward, Ireland experienced intensified colonisation under British rule, including the plantations, the penal laws, and the gradual erosion of Irish land ownership, language, and political autonomy. These policies marginalised the native Catholic majority and established a Protestant ascendancy aligned with English interests. And this created a really deep resentment and a growing sense of cultural and national displacement among the Irish population. By the 19th century, the discontent had intensified. The Act of Union in 1801 dissolved the Irish Parliament and officially integrated Ireland into the United Kingdom, centralising legislative power in London. And this political move was widely viewed as a betrayal by many Irish nationalists, and it led to a period of cultural suppression and economic hardship. The Great Famine of 1845 to 1852 even further deepened this divide, and it resulted in mass starvation, death, and emigration. And these were events that many saw as exacerbated by, or outright caused by, British negligence and exploitative economic structures. In response to this cultural and political crisis, the Celtic revival emerged in the mid to late 19th century as a movement to reclaim and celebrate Ireland's distinct cultural heritage, particularly things like its mythology, its language, folklore, and pre-colonial history. Romantic nationalism became a powerful force, and Irish intellectuals and artists sought to reinterpret mythic figures like Deirdre, not just as literary subjects, but as emblems of national identity. And it was in this context that Deirdre's story was radically reimagined. No longer just a cautionary tale of personal tragedy, she came to represent the feminized embodiment of Ireland itself, a beautiful, noble figure violated by an oppressive male authority, mirroring the nation's subjugation under British rule. Writers like Thomas Davis, who was a founding member of the Young Ireland movement, drew upon ancient Irish legends to inspire patriotic sentiment and to promote cultural revival. By aligning Deirdre's suffering with Ireland's colonial plight, Davis and others helped transform her into a symbol of resistance, mourning, and hope, reinforcing the idea that Irish identity was rooted in a glorious mythic past that had been lost, but could be reclaimed. And that reinterpretation also reflected much broader trends in European romantic nationalism, where nations under imperial pressure turned myth, legend, and folklore into sources of unity and legitimacy. In Ireland's case, figures like Deirdre functioned as a symbolic martyr, channeling centuries of dispossession, betrayal, and longing for autonomy, giving emotional and narrative form to Ireland's struggle for cultural and political self-determination. A pivotal moment in the reinterpretation of Deirdre as a political symbol came with William Butler Yeats and his 1907 play Deirdre, first performed at Abbey Theatre. Written during a period of intense nationalist agitation and cultural revival, Yeats' Deirdre explicitly reframed this ancient myth as a modern political allegory, drawing really extremely clear parallels between Deirdre's personal tragedy and Ireland's historical subjugation under foreign rule. And in this play, Deirdre is no longer just this passive victim of fate, but she's actually a luminous, tragic figure who embodies both resistance and inevitability. Her forced return to this aging tyrannical king becomes, again, a symbol of Ireland being dragged back into the grasp of imperial domination, despite its yearnings for freedom. Yeats uses the language of mourning and prophecy to evoke deep cultural and political lamentation. Early on in the play, Deirdre's voice becomes a bit of a national lament. She says, "I cannot go. I must die by the hands of those I hate. But I will not die until I have shown them that the beauty of the world can be a terrible thing." And this line really reflects the romantic nationalist ideal that beauty, particularly feminine and mythic beauty, can both uplift and destroy, much like Ireland itself, whose cultural richness becomes this source of pride and grief under colonisation. And Yeats also gives Deirdre this sense of tragic foreknowledge, and that echoes the prophetic voice often assigned to colonised people in literature. In one of the play's final moments, Deirdre speaks with this eerie clarity about the cost of returning to the king and to the world that has betrayed her. She says, "They shall praise me and weep for me, saying, she was too beautiful to live, too proud to bow. And so I shall have a greater peace than theirs who go on living." Here, Deirdre is consciously choosing symbolic martyrdom, a theme that Yeats often returned to in his plays and poems, particularly when addressing the Irish cause. Her death is not just tragic, it's like a sacrifice. It's a gesture of defiance wrapped in silence. It's, again, echoing this like mythic fatalism that Yeats saw as deeply Irish and spiritually transcendent. The mythic treatment of Deirdre reflects Yeats' broader efforts in mythopoetic nationalism, using ancient Irish figures to construct a visionary narrative of Irish identity that transcends politics, but is pretty undeniably steeped in a symbolic struggle for freedom and meaning. So Deirdre becomes more than just a character. She's myth remade as a message. She's holding up a mirror to Ireland's pain and yearning, and serving as a reminder that national identity is just as much forged through suffering as it is through heroism. And this particular reinterpretation of Deirdre was far from an isolated impulse. It was definitely part of a much larger cultural and ideological movement, which is the Gaelic revival of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And as I said, this movement wanted to recover and revalorize Ireland's mythological and pre-colonial heritage. And central to this, the ethos of this, was the resurrection of Celtic myth and language and folklore, because this was material that had very long been dismissed or marginalised under colonial frameworks as primitive, which is a tale as old as time when we get to this point in history where, you know, colonialism is happening and colonised people's religions and pantheons are, you know, looked at as barbaric or primitive. So during this revival, figures like Cú Chulainn and Deirdre were deliberately recast as national icons. They were given all of this symbolic meaning that resonated with contemporary anxieties. And in this context, Deirdre was elevated to near sacred status as part of a mythic pantheon of Irish resistance, transformed into an allegorical embodiment of sovereignty and spiritual resilience. She was celebrated, and her story became one of many cultural artefacts reactivated for national revival. But underneath all of this symbolic elevation is a really important and maybe overlooked tension, which is the gendered dynamics of mythmaking. Because while Deirdre was consistently central to this nationalist iconography, her voice and her agency and her inner life were frequently told through male authorship. So you got writers like Yeats, J.M. Synge and George Russell, and they all mythologised her in ways that reflected male ideas and male projections and anxieties, often emphasising things like her beauty, her suffering and sacrificial role rather than exploring her inner complexity or any potential defiance. And there is a lot of scholarly work about this that I have read. So, for instance, Margaret Llewellyn Davies and Patricia Coughlin have noted that this phenomenon reveals a pretty common trend in revival-era literature, where female figures symbolise the nation, but they rarely really spoke for themselves. Deirdre was used as a metaphor rather than a subject. She was a passive vessel for national longing, rather than a fully realised character. And the idealisation of feminine purity and sacrifice often served to legitimise patriarchal and militarised narratives of a national struggle. And that sidelines the real women's role in revolutionary movements, and it really limits the feminine representation to archetypes of martyrdom or musehood. And that contradiction, this one between celebrating and silencing, highlights the complexities of this revival itself, because while it empowered Irish cultural self-expression and reconnected the nation with its mythic past, it also perpetuated certain romanticised and gendered limitations, particularly in how it constructed women within nationalist discourse. More recent feminist reinterpretations of Deirdre have sought to reclaim her story from this tradition, restoring her subjectivity, challenging patriarchal structures, and offering alternative narratives where female desire, voice, and resistance are in the foreground, rather than just sort of like wishy-washy symbolic stuff. And by the turn of the 20th century, Deirdre had very much transcended her literary roots. She wasn't just this doomed heroine anymore. She's a bit of a muse, She's a bit of a political metaphor and a symbol for cultural trauma. She really reflected a trend in Irish literature where myth was weaponized to articulate political oppression and national longing. And even in contemporary reinterpretations, Deirdre's story continues to be a site of gendered and nationalistic exploration, revisited by feminist scholars and writers seeking to reclaim her voice and her agency. So on that note, I think it's probably a good time for us to move on to modern day Deirdre.
History Daily is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. So visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
In the modern world, Deirdre continues to resonate across multiple cultural and intellectual registers, not just as a remnant of myth or literature, but as more of a living symbol, variously interpreted as a literary icon, a feminist archetype, and a cultural mirror. And although she's no longer tethered strictly to her medieval origins in the Ulster cycle, Deirdre endures as a powerful figure through whom themes of grief, resistance, female agency, and collective trauma are continuously re-examined. And while Deirdre is not venerated in any formal religious framework, she's in this kind of quasi-sacred space within both academic discourse and neo-spiritual circles, particularly among Celtic revivalists and feminist neo-pagan communities. In these kinds of settings, Deirdre is frequently invoked not as a deity per se, but as a symbolic goddess, as an emblem of mourning and rebellion and passionate love unjustly thwarted. She's, I guess, kind of a touchstone for those exploring feminine sorrow and how powerful heartbreak can be, especially in contexts such as ritual storytelling, spoken word poetry, and women's healing circles. And if we take a little look at Deirdre through the lens of feminist literature, she really has undergone quite a significant reclamation, because she's no longer confined to the role of a passive, tragic beauty destroyed by men and forces beyond her control. She's been more increasingly read as an active subject who challenges patriarchal authority, even when that challenge still results in her downfall. And I read a dissertation called Celtic Pagan Influence in the Early Irish Church. Bit of a mouthful. And in this dissertation, McNally, who wrote it, argues that Deirdre's refusal to acquiesce to the will of the king and her, you know, let's face it, pretty bold elopement can be read as an early act of feminist defiance. And I'll read you a little quote from this, but I will put the link to the full dissertation in the show notes as per usual. But one thing that particularly stood out to me was this part here. Deirdre chooses exile over submission, love over duty, and death over dishonour. In doing so, she embodies a proto-feminist agency that ruptures the narrative of obedient femininity expected in both myth and medieval morality. So what does that mean? Well, this framing of Deirdre transforms her tragedy into a form of resistance, a willful assertion of autonomy in a world where women's choices were not only constrained but also weaponized against them. Her story resonates with ongoing feminist concerns, particularly those surrounding the commodification of women's bodies, the suppression of female grief, and the politicization of women's emotional and sexual autonomy. And if we have a look at contemporary Irish scholars, feminist scholars like Catherine Shannon, there is an essay that she wrote called Sovereign Sorrows, Women's Grief as Resistance in Irish Myth. Again, really recommend it. We'll put it in the show notes. And I could quote a lot of this. I could read you the whole thing, but I won't. I've picked out a very specific bit where Shannon writes, Deirdre, like so many mythic women, is not destroyed by love, but by the system that refuses her the right to choose it. Her voice, though silenced in death, echoes through centuries of patriarchal erasure, reminding us that grief can be a form of rebellion. And I loved that line. I loved it very much. And that take puts Deirdre in this lineage of female figures whose narratives have been historically shaped, but also distorted by male-dominated storytelling traditions, but who nonetheless persist as icons of resistance and memory. And I think, you know, I've been doing this podcast for you know, going on 2 years now, and that resonates with so many of the figures that I've discussed, and so many that I will go on to discuss. So I guess, if you think about it like that, Deirdre speaks not only to Irish cultural history, but also to this broader global, really, feminist discourse about reclaiming all of these lost and silenced female voices. And just to take it outside the academic sphere for a sec, Deirdre's story has been actively reimagined in artistic and spiritual communities, especially, as I said earlier, those influenced by contemporary neo-paganism, goddess spirituality, and Celtic mysticism. And Deirdre is often symbolically associated with goddesses of sorrow, fate, and love, and she functions like a mythic avatar of feminine endurance. Rituals and workshops might focus on the Deirdre archetype, and they invite participants, who are very often women, to engage with the themes of betrayal, exile, and longing, and emotional serenity that are associated with Deirdre and her story. And in this modern mythopoetic practice, Deirdre's story isn't just sort of retold, but it is experienced. It's experienced as a really deeply personal and collective rite of passage. Poets and visual artists and playwrights, particularly women, have also turned to Deirdre's narrative as, I guess, like a canvas or foundation for contemporary reinterpretation. Her mythic presence endures in modern Irish poetry and is often told through a feminist or a post-colonial lens. And I went on a little bit of a hunt for some poetry to read to you guys, and I found one called The Oral Tradition by Eivind Boland. And again, this is one of those things where I'm going to tell you, you really need to read this. You really do. But this poem at its heart is an act of reclamation. And in the poem, Boland reflects on the uneasy relationship between official history and the stories that live on in memory, particularly those stories of women, which often survive in more fragmented ways, in whispers, in what's passed from voice to voice. And she's deeply interested in what happens to women who fall outside the written record, whose lives were maybe considered to be too boring, too domestic, or just too inconvenient to preserve in history. And Boland sort of suggests that oral tradition is both a very powerful thing, but also a bit of a precarious thing. Because it does keep women's experiences alive, but it also really exposes how easily those experiences can be distorted or softened or just lost altogether. And throughout the poem, there's this sort of tension between what's remembered and what's recorded, between the authority of written history, but the more intimate truth of lived experiences. And it's something that we spoke about before. I feel like I really spoke about this a lot when I did my little series leading up to Christmas over on Patreon. But in elevating all of this sort of quiet form of transmission, Boland is suggesting that the private sphere, you know, things like the kitchen table, the family, traditions and stories and things that are passed down, the remembered voice. These things aren't separate from history. They are part of its very foundation. And Boland does a really good job of critiquing this silencing of women in myth and history. So I thought I'd read you that poem. I hope that's okay. But I will also put a link to it in the show notes as well. I was standing there at the end of a reading or a workshop or whatever, watching people heading out into the weather, only half wondering what becomes of words, the brisk herbs of language, the fragrances we think we sing, if anything. We were left behind, in a firelit room in which the colour scheme crouched well down, golds, a sort of dun, a distressed ochre. And the sole richness was in the suggestion of a texture, like the low flax gleam that comes off polished leather. Two women were standing in shadow, one with her back turned. Their talk was a gesture, an outstretched hand. They talked to each other, and words like summer, birth, great-grandmother kept pleading with me, urging me to follow. She could feel it coming, one of them was saying. All the way there across the fields at evening and no one there, God help her. And she had on a skirt of cross-woven linen and the little one kept pulling at it. It was nearly night. Wood hissed and split in the open grate, broke apart in sparks, a windfall of light in the room's darkness. When she lay down and gave birth to him in an open meadow. What a child that was to be born without a blemish. It had started raining, the windows dripping, misted. One moment I was standing, not seeing out, only half listening, staring at the night. The next, without warning, I was caught by it. The bruised summer light, the musical subtext of mauve eaves on lilac, and the laburnum passed in shadow where the lime tree dropped its bracts in frills of contrast. Where she lay down in vetch and linen and lifted up her son to the archive they would shelter in. The oral song, avid as superstition, layered like an amber in the wreck of language and the remnants of a nation. I was getting out my coat, buttoning it, shrugging up the collar. It was bitter outside, a real winter's night, and I had distances ahead of me. Iron miles in trains, iron rails repeating instances and reasons, the wheels singing innuendos, hints, outlines underneath the surface. A sense suddenly of truth, its resonance. And I really love that. I really love that poem. Because when we look at Deirdre, we see exactly what Boland is getting at in this poem. Because Deirdre's story doesn't come to us as this sort of neat, stable history. It comes through layers of retelling, shaped by memory and performance and the priorities of those who preserved it. So like these women that are having a conversation in this poem, Deirdre survives in that really fragile but also equally powerful space between official record and the living voice. And if you look, there are tons of other poems that give a similar message. There is The Flower Master, The Question of Language, and many, many more. And I will, again, put all of the links in the show notes so you can read these. And though these don't necessarily name Deirdre specifically, this imagery of fragile exile, the silence of women, and sacred grief all parallel Deirdre's journey and spiritual resonance. And in all of these cases, Deirdre just becomes less of a legend and more of a lyrical symbol of survival, grief and defiance. And that really speaks to both historical trauma and enduring female agency. Elsewhere in literature, Deirdre has been reimagined in several works of modern historical and mythic fiction, most notably in novels by Morgan Llewellyn and Juliet Marillia, where she's often portrayed through a romanticised and emotionally rich lens. In Llewellyn's Red Branch of 1989, which is a retelling of the Ulster Cycle, Deirdre is cast as a very sensual and emotionally intelligent figure, her love rendered with great tenderness. And Llewellyn does give her a bit more psychological depth than the earlier mythic versions, but the focus does remain primarily on romantic tragedy and emotional suffering, with Deirdre often framed as a victim of fate and desire, rather than a politically resonant symbol of resistance. And similarly, in Juliet Marillier's Daughter of the Forest of 1999 and her subsequent novels, although these aren't direct retellings of Deirdre's tale, the narrative style and the characterizations are very heavily inspired by Celtic myth archetypes like Deirdre, These women who endure betrayal, exile, and enforced silence, often finding strength through suffering and love. And Deirdre also appears in visual art with artists like Louis Le Procoy and Harry Clark playing pretty significant roles in shaping these visual interpretations of Deirdre in the modern world, each using a very distinctive style to evoke the emotional and symbolic weight of her story. Le Brocoy's art and illustrations focus primarily on the wider Ulster cycle, but they do include very haunting minimalist renderings of Deirdre that very powerfully capture her psychological torment and existential isolation. His Deirdre isn't this romanticised beauty, but she's a figure often reduced to a fragile, ghostly presence with hollow eyes and stark outlines and this body that almost looks like it's dissolving into the page. And I guess in a way that sort of aesthetic really emphasises her marginality and her voicelessness, and that presents her as more of a spectral trace of loss and less of a woman, which I guess aligns with these modern interpretations of Deirdre as a symbol of cultural mourning. And in contrast to that, Harry Clark's earlier work, particularly, he's got these stained glass panels and illustrated books, and they present a bit more of a gothic and ornate version of Irish myth. His portrayal of Deirdre leans a little bit more into the decadent aesthetic. She's more sort of like luminescent. She's a very sorrowful beauty draped in these intricate robes and surrounded by dark, foreboding patterns. She's very ethereal, very sensual, maybe even a little bit more angelic, but always marked by this tragic inevitability. And it's just really interesting to see these contrasting visions of Deirdre, you know, with Clark emphasising this sort of visual opulence of sorrow, whereas Brocoy stripping her down to the bare essence of suffering and symbolic erasure, which is a bit more, probably a little closer to post-war existentialism than romantic myth. But both of them do reinforce Deirdre's status as an icon of loss, captivity and feminine tragedy, shaped just as much by artistic vision as by the enduring power of her myth. And musically, the story of Deirdre of the Sorrows has inspired a huge body of work across genres, from classical art music to Celtic folk ballads, all often drawing on the emotional intensity and the tragic beauty of her myth. One of the most notable classical works is Howard Ferguson's piano suite Deirdre's Lament of 1941. And that's, I mean, I'm not a music critic, right? But to me, it's very despairing. I have listened. It sounds very despairing, and it kind of gives this sense of isolation, you know? And it feels like a mourning song. It feels sad. It feels like it's very much reflecting that devastation, that devastating emotional arc that Deirdre goes through. In the folk music world, Deirdre's influence is definitely felt through lyrical storytelling and atmospheric arrangements. And often, again, just like in poetry and in literature, it's not directly about Deirdre, but you can really feel her presence and themes that resonate with her within the lyrics. And there is a Canadian Celtic fusion artist called Lorena McKennett, and who I discovered in the research for this episode. And she explores Irish and pan-Celtic myths in her music and has songs like The Mummer's Dance and The Bonnie Swans, and please feel free to go and have a listen to them. But they also draw on this archetype of the doomed or exiled woman, which, again, not directly referencing Deirdre, but it definitely is giving the vibes. It's giving Deirdre vibes. It's giving Deirdre, to me, anyway. And then in neo-paganism sort of settings, Deirdre's tale continues to inspire musicians there. And she's often featured in ritual music, ambient Celtic albums, and thematic song cycles. And artists in this circle, neo-pagan and goddess music circles, like Kellyanna or Lisa Thiel, have produced songs that, again, not always name Deirdre, but they definitely embody her archetype, this grieving, sovereign woman who resists the patriarchy. And those types of works are often performed in women's circles, at spiritual gatherings, or seasonal festivals, keeping the emotional resonance of her myth alive in ritual performance. And as I said, you know, not all of these musical adaptations, in fact, not many of them, name her explicitly. But they are very, very clear about the themes. These themes of tragic love and exile and fate and feminine sorrow. And those are themes that continue to echo through Celtic-inspired music across time. Deirdre remains, I guess, a sonic archetype. You know, she's haunting this landscape of classical composition and oral tradition, and I guess just reminding people who are listening of the power of myth and the power of myth set to music. And so Deirdre endures, not just as this tragic heroine of Irish myth, but as a living echo in stories, in songs, on the stage, in our imaginations. From medieval warnings to nationalist allegories, from feminist reclamations to spectral artwork and mournful melodies, she's moved across centuries and has been constantly reshaped by the mouths and hands that retell her. In every single version of her story, her sorrow speaks in new ways. Of her exile and her beauty and her resistance and her voice. And she's really a very strong reminder that myth is never static. It lives with us. It evolves with us. And in the case of Deirdre, it continues to whisper truth to power through the language of lament. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode of Ladies of Lore. I really hope that you've enjoyed it. If you have, let me know. If you are able to, on the platform that you are listening on right now, feel free to leave me a comment or a review. You can reach out on TikTok, on Patreon, on Discord or Blue Sky. Everything is in the show notes, along with the sources that I have used for today's episode. It's been a really good one, guys, and I'm not going to lie to you, the next episode I have for you is pretty cool. It's really cool. You got some good stuff to look forward to, but you can get that early if you join the Patreon. Thank you once again, and I'll be back next time to unravel another thread in the rich tapestry of women in mythology and folklore.